Hi, my name is Brittany Cavill, and I am the Youth Engagement Specialist for the South Southwest Mental Health Technology Transfer Center.
And I'm Nadia Callen, Check Me Nerd. I'm the Trauma Informed and Healing Centered Engagement Specialist over at the Mental Health Technology Transfer Center.
And our podcast today is on healing centered engagement, and we're so excited to be having this conversation with Dr. Sean Jenright. Dr. Sean Jenright is one of the nation's leading innovators, provocateurs, and thought leaders on African American youth activism, and youth development. He is a professor of education in the Africana Studies Department and a senior research associate at San Francisco State University. Dr. Jenright is founder and chief executive officer of Flourish Agenda Incorporated, a national nonprofit consulting firm whose mission is to design strategies that unlock the power of healing and engage youth of color and adult allies in transforming their schools and communities. Dr. Jenright currently serves as chairman of the board for the California Endowment, whose mission is to improve the health of Californians' underserved communities. The South Southwest Mental Health Technology Transfer Center serves Region 6, which includes Arkansas, Louisiana, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas. Our population focuses on mental health clinicians, supervisors, and program managers serving individuals with or at risk serious emotional disturbances or severe mental illnesses, peer support providers, community health workers, or peer-run organizations, and single state agency administrators focused on comprehensive state public health systems. In this podcast and in our work with MHTTC, we seek to support the mental health workforce, increasing their capacity to provide culturally responsive, effective interventions that enhance the quality of life of individuals they serve. Before we get started, I'd like to do a quick check to see how's everyone feeling before we start diving into the conversation. So how are we feeling today?
Feeling great. A lot of changes and pivots, but I'm ready to go.
This is the year of pivots. That's what I like to say.
Yeah. It's the title of my new book, actually, which I'll talk about.
Wonderful. So I thought just to get us started, Dr. Jenright, you could help us by laying down the foundations of a healing-centered framework for those of us who just haven't met you yet and are just hearing this for the first time.
Yeah, so a lot of us are trained to think about harm and trauma through the lens, through sort of a medical clinical lens. That is that something happens to an individual that disrupts that individual's normal level of functioning, and that we can respond or work with that individual to restore their normal level of functioning. And while the medical model is useful in understanding harm, it falls short of describing the magnitude, depth, and complexity of the ways in which young people experience persistent harm in their neighborhoods and communities. So for example, we use the term, you may be familiar with the term, post-traumatic stress disorder, which describes the experience of an act of trauma and the disruptive behavior that comes from that experience. The term, while it's adequate to describe the behavior on the ways in which human beings experience trauma and its aftermath, it is inadequate to describe the complexity and the ongoing trauma that young people of communities of color experience. So, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder is a term that came from a description in the DSM, I don't remember the right diagnostic manual, but we also recognize and realize that there's nothing post about the experience that young people experience. They could experience trauma today, tomorrow, next month. And so it is a persistent experience. And second, there's a way in which post-traumatic stress disorder, it's called a disorder, which is located in the individual. So something is wrong with me. Something is dysfunctional about me. When in fact, if we use that medical model, then we place the dysfunction at the individual rather than the environment that caused the dysfunction in the first place. And so I prefer the term persistent traumatic stress environment that more accurately describes the ways in which the broader environmental features and factors create harm and disruption. And thirdly, I don't know if this is third, I'm losing count. Sorry, Nadia and Brittany. But that trauma doesn't always occur at the individual level. That is, that you can go to communities in our country, you can go to LA, you can go to Bronx, you can go to Philadelphia, you can go to Austin, right? And you could talk to young people of color there's going to be a similar experience of trauma. Just think for a moment how you felt, not what happened, but how you felt when you watched for the first time what happened to Mr. Floyd. Right? Just think about that experience of how you felt in your stomach, how you felt in your heart. That experience right now is being called up for you. Many millions of people felt that same way. And that's called a collective experience of trauma. And so when we use a medical model, while it is necessary, it's insufficient to really capture the complexity and breadth of the ways in that trauma happens in our society. And so when young people of color watched what happened to Mr. Floyd, the same process that you just experienced, the way that brought up for you happens to young people of color. And so we need another model. We need another way to respond to that. And so part of healing-centered engagement is a clarity about what causes harm in the first place. And then second, what healing-centered engagement, the premise is that it is an asset-based approach. It says that we're not going to start with the worst thing that happened to you, but we're gonna ask questions and build from your restoration on the what's right with you. It's an approach that is holistic, is culturally grounded, and it's based in the possibilities and potential of the assets that young people bring to us. That was a long explanation to a simple question.
Yeah, and every time I hear you say that, I feel like, yes, and then there are so many layers. And so thank you so much for that explanation. And I gather from just even the examples that you provided that there's been some evolution over the time that we, or at least an evolution in being able to conceptualize this for people in the time of COVID. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, when I began working on this and began writing this, you know, there was no such thing as COVID. And so if healing-centered engagement was necessary and important, you know, 2 years ago when I began writing and thinking about that, it is critically important now. So this notion of collective harm, well, we all experiencing gross levels of uncertainty, right? So the research suggests that when we all experience high levels of uncertainty, high levels of anxiety, which is what we're all experiencing now collectively, that sense of uncertainty and anxiety produces what a researcher by the name of James Gabarino calls social toxicity. And social toxins are like physical toxins, like asbestos and lead paint. Like if you're eating and digesting asbestos and lead paint, if you did that over time, it would make you sick, right? And you would become ill. And if you didn't go to the doctor and get healed from your exposure to physical toxins, it could become lethal. Well, research says that the same thing happens with social toxins. And social toxins are things like uncertainty, fear, anxiety, stress, that those things are just as present and just as toxic to our well-being. But oftentimes in our schools, our community-based programs, schools of social work, we're given one tool to deal with that, and that's discipline, all right, or punishment. And that a more healing-centered approach says that I have to understand your assets and understand the root causes of what's causing your behavior, and then begin to work with restoring aspects of your person that has been harmed.
Yeah.
One aspect of working with young people that I particularly have found extremely helpful is working with young people to understand their environment and understand the multiple moving parts that goes into how their environment is created and what their place is in the future and how their voice can help to change the environment over time. And I'm interested to see what your thoughts are on the role that youth activism plays in providing space for healing for young people.
Great question. So hopefully you've had an opportunity to talk to one of my best friends and colleagues, Dr. Julio Camarota, about yes. Youth activism and youth participatory practices. So here's how youth activism is healing. Youth activism produces this magic ingredient that's sometimes absent from schools and youth development programs and juvenile probation. And that magic ingredient is called hope. And hope has three, and this is based off Snyder's research on hope and hope theory, but there are three things that youth activism produces in young people. The first is a future goal orientation. That is, I could see not only myself, but my community in the future, that I have a role in the future. And then I can actually begin to think and imagine what that might be. The second is agency. We know that one of the consequences of oppression, racism, classism, all of the structural inequality that, young people face sort of harms young people's sense of agency. That is, I can't do anything about it. That's just the way it is. What youth activism does is says, I have a voice and I have the capacity to actually confront and change and transform those things that actually create harm. And the third is sort of pathways, right? The opportunity structure. When young people can actually begin to work with adult allies, they can actually do an analysis of those policies and practices that block them from access to things, that they're creating pathways of possibility. And so through future goal orientation, through a sense of agency and creating those structures, together those things create hope. And hope is one of the most important ingredients in healing. You really hope you cannot have a democracy. You can't have it. You can't have a healthy, robust democracy without hope, which is the moment we're in right now, right? That if people believe that no matter what I do matters, I'm not going to vote, I'm not going to do this, that, you know, whatever, this is more than just pulling back from the body politic. It is really about hope. And that is the ability to actually change the conditions that we think need to be modified for our well-being.
I definitely agree, because without hope, young people are not able to, they're not able to dream. They're not able to see a future in a positive light and see themselves in a positive light and that they're a contribution to society. And so my next question is, how do you see dreaming for young people manifesting into healing? And do you believe that it can heal generational trauma?
Woo, just a little easy question like that.
I came prepared today.
So I've said before, and I've written that dreaming and imagination is perhaps the most radical act of justice we can engage in. And that's because one thing that oppression does is that it tells communities that the most radical thing you could do is try to end me. So racism, this is why I'm very critical and I want people to be thoughtful about the term anti-racism. And that's because we have a way of defining what we want through the absence of what we don't. This means, for example, that the absence of violence doesn't constitute peace. The absence of illness doesn't constitute health. The absence of racism doesn't define what we want. Let me say it in a different way. Anti-racism sometimes is akin to saying, I anti-hate you so much. Would you please marry me? I'm defining what I want in the absence of what I don't, as opposed to I love you so much. Would you please marry me? No one would enter a relationship with someone saying, I anti-hate you so much. Would you please marry me? Because we're not compelled to enter a relationship about what somebody doesn't want. And so in the same way, we need to be very mindful of, and I'm using that to be, you know, kind of provocative. But what dreaming does, back to your question, Brittany, what dreaming does is it allows us to see and say the future that we want, as opposed to defining it through the absence of what we don't. Dreaming allows us to say, I want a society of belongingness. What dreaming says is that I want a society where everyone has concern about each other. What dreaming says is that I want structures of justice. I want structures of belonging, right? Now, to get that, we need anti-racism. We need anti-homophobia. We need all these sorts of things. But we need to practice dreaming and imagination so that it allows us to see and say what we want in the future, as opposed to only addressing the things and eliminating the things we don't. Let me just say this one last thing, Brittany. Many of us who have been trained in activism define our work through these kinds of terms. I want to fight injustice. I want to resist racism. I want to confront patriarchy. I want to, I want to deconstruct capitalism. Fight, confront, resist. You've heard these terms, right? Those terms are important prerequisite to creating the society that we want. They're prerequisite, but they fail to define precisely what we do want. So I gave my students an assignment and I said, I want you to talk about your work, but you can't use the term fight, resist, confront, deconstruct, destroy. You can't use those terms. You can only use terms like dream, imagine, create, play, invent. And it was really hard for them because they were so used to defining their work in terms of what they wanted to remove rather than defining their work and what they wanted to create. What dreaming and imagination does for healing is that it allows for us to say and see the future, the desirable future that we want, which is a critical component of our well-being. Long explanation for a great, great question.
Well, still along these lines, because I've seen some progress like within my own experience, but that dreaming and seeing a future, it creates hope and healing personally, individually. What role do you think it plays in healing the generational trauma that we carry with us? And so the trauma that is collectively experienced like amongst families, amongst a family group, when they are investing and pouring into their young person and they're able to dream and they're able to see a future. Do you think that that helps to heal collective generational trauma?
Well, you know, it has and it always will. So our ancestors did not dream of ending slavery. They dreamed of freedom. And so in the same way, I think part of the intergenerational, the way that dreaming helps us to heal our intergenerational trauma is that it compels us and pushes us towards the optimum desirable future, just like our ancestors did who were enslaved, right? It forces us to look at the desirable future that we want as opposed to only, and I'm not saying this is an either or. We need to fight, confront, deconstruct all that's necessary, but it is not the entire equation. And so what this does in terms of intergenerational trauma, it gives us a language that allows us to then begin to work on generation after generation after generation. I want to create a society full of belonging. I want us to create a society where the structures are connected, where everybody matters. What does that look like? A radical democracy where everybody's, no matter what they look like, actually have an equal say and equal whatever. So it means that we work on the thing that we're trying to achieve, right? This is what Dr. King has always said to us. He says, we are moving to create a beloved community, right? Dr. King wasn't just about deconstructing racism. And right now, to get to beloved community, a community where we all belong and have a sense of belonging, is a bigger long-term generational process. It's not that something you create in a five-year strategic plan.
So I've worked in many different communities and I've had the pleasure of being a recipient of services or community engagement processes. And when I got older, I felt it was very important for me to do the same and be a similar asset. And so what I found is that I have a unique experience that I bring when I work with communities of color and young people in particular. And I, for one, believe that that experience cannot be taught. It's hard to be taught. And so my question is, how can allies replicate the work with communities of color without the cultural humility that we as Black, Indigenous people of color gain from our lived experience?
Mm. Ooh, you just keep asking me all these easy questions, right? A really good question. It's a very thoughtful and very good question. Someone asked me about 10 years ago at a big conference and I was talking about belonging and did this keynote. And then they came up to me afterwards. They were talking, we'd like your keynote, but I have a question. We are our social work students. Can you teach someone how to care? Is caring something that could be taught or trained? And I didn't have a good answer to that at that time. I do now. So your question about your lived experience matters, definitely matters. What our lived experience does is it says that I see you and I care about you. I have compassion for your condition because it's my condition too, damn it. You are not them, you are me. Does this make sense? Right, so that's what our lived experience does. It says, I'm not us and them, it's we. Now, in order to get we lean into our lived experience, because you know what it feels like to be not included in whatever. You know what I'm saying, right? So you,
yes.
It is not only an exclusive experience. It is an experience that allows us to have care and compassion. Now, let's say you don't have that experience. Is it possible that you could still have compassion, care, and integrity with communities that you know nothing about? Absolutely. But that takes work. It takes work to see your own humanity is connected to those that are most dislike you. That takes work. And so that's the part of radical healing. That's the part of healing centered engagement. It means that if I don't come from African-American community that's been disenfranchised in an urban space, if I don't have that, it means that I have to do much more work, unlearn my stigma of you, to heal from my own stigma, my own social toxicity, in order to see your humanity. It's not easy work, but that's the work we've been called to do if we are to engage in a healing process. The reason I was late for this one is because I was just talking to a group of 30 to 40 social workers that are being trained around racial injustice, and they were being trained, you know, all the right theories and all the right analysis of racial inequality in their work. But fundamentally, my point was that if they're not engaged in their own restoration, their ability to see others as human, even those that are most dislike them, then in some ways what'll happen is that they'll reproduce inequality. This moment we're in our society, this idea is perhaps the most critical idea that's so important. It doesn't matter who sits in that throne after November 3rd. What matters is that we have the capacity as a nation to see the humanity in even in those that disagree with us. And that's called healing. And we can only get there if we really work on that process.
Wow. Thank you.
I answered your question.
Yes. Yes. I think what I heard was that they have to really engage in the work, and meaning their allies have to be on the ground and they have to really confront issues and try to have a level of understanding and humility that they aren't going to get from learning theories. You're not going to get it all from an academic setting. You have to really take the time to learn and understand the lived experience of the communities that you're looking to work with.
One step further, Brittany, it's not understand, is have compassion for, which is not a learned thing, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have a way of doing the deep reflection to get compassion for other people, right? So that's my answer to your question and the one I got 10 years ago, which is I don't have to train you. Human beings are built for care and compassion. It's just we learn who to care and have compassion for. We're wired for compassion. We would not survive as a human species if we didn't have compassion, because we wouldn't care for our babies, right? We'd be like, oh, you're too screaming, you loud, I'm out. So we're wired for compassion and care. That's our nature and DNA is for that. What we've learned how to do is direct it towards certain groups and not others. That's the thing we have to unlearn. Hard work.
Thank you.
But I've seen it.
Very hard work.
No one says it's going to be easy.
And I'm going to go in a different direction, but I think it's kind of underneath a lot of the things, especially when you were speaking about manifesting dreams, going into the direction of the body and our connection to the body and healing, because I sometimes feel like folks may not have the answer to what does healing look like, feel like, and sound like, and taste like, and smell like. So again, you know, a lot of people talk about healing in relation to their bodies. Can you provide any insight into how this connects to the healing-centered framework in your experience?
All really good questions. Let me explain that in two ways, through two examples of where I first start thinking about healing. I was trained mostly to see youth development, right? To see the kind of youth development trajectory. And I did these programs and created programs to really focus on young people's development. We had a summer camp where we would bring in these are mostly African-American young people from urban spaces throughout the Bay Area. And two incidents happened. One, many of the young men that came to the camp, these were young brothers, 14, 15, 16. They would come in with their hoodies on, glasses, and they didn't feel safe. So the hoodie was a way of them feeling safe. And they didn't want to interact with one another. Over 3 days, we saw those young men take their hoodies off and play like children, because they had never played before, literally played. So healing looks like joyful expression of their bodies. You know, these young boys that from Baby Hunter's point didn't have hoodies on. They were running out, running around without their shirts on because it was sunny and they were free and they weren't afraid of anything. So it looks like a sense of joyful expression. Second is that healing looks like I have the capacity to say what's inside. So many young men and women of color, including my own son to a certain extent, have been socialized to be emotionally illiterate. That means that when I ask you, how are you doing? No matter what happens, they respond in three ways. I'm cool, I'm all right, I'm good. Now, if you've worked with young men before, or and young women too, you probably experienced that very thin response. I'm cool, I'm all right, I'm good. They did not have the capacity to say, I'm afraid, I'm scared, I'm embarrassed, I'm shamed. Whatever it is, didn't have the tools to go down in there and say, this is what I'm feeling right now. I'm feeling this. These are the two things I'm feeling right now. So what healing looks like is when young men can say, you know what? I'm afraid right now, or I'm really angry right now at the world because I don't have anyone to go to. My parents have abandoned me, or I feel really hopeful right now because I finally have a job, or whatever it is healing looks like, I have the capacity to take the thing out and name it.
Mm-hmm.
Third, healing looks like I feel safe enough to cry. Healing looks like I feel safe enough to heal with everyone without judgment. Healing looks like a sanctuary space, right? So that's why we go to church. We go to church because no one, I don't know if you've ever been, y'all ever been to a Black church, but in a Black church, you yell, say amen, and jump and cry and scream and catch the Holy Ghost, and nobody's going to be like, what's up with her? No, there's an acceptance, a community of vulnerable acceptance that allows people to courageously experience their own healing and well-being in whatever way they want. So the third thing is healing looks like unjudged expression. It's sort of sanctuary space. That's why healing has to be collective. We can't experience sanctuary space in the privacy of a therapist room or in my own room. That has to be collective, right? A friend of mine said that when we talk about healing, if I'm sick, we sick.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm well, we well. And so this idea that healing happens in a sanctuary space is also a part of what I would see. If I went into an organization, if I went into a school, if I went into anywhere, I would be able to name, here are the things I would see if this is a healing space. Aside from asking young people what they feel like.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say like that, you know, there was mom, you know, when you asked the question, because I had the same experience with persons with lived experience and peers asking them to connect sensations to healing. And they were like, what was that all about? It is because we're often part of the practice of keeping us separated is also keeping us separated from our bodies and our collective bodies as well. And so it's a radical act to defy that and to connect with your body and know what it's saying and have the sensations and have like so many words for one feeling. And so along that line, I have seen a lot of school mental health professionals as well as advocates, specifically sex educators who are integrating a healing-centered framework. What are your thoughts on healing as translated into other areas of practice? Because I have seen this with peer support services as well. So a lot of people are taking like ducks to water with healing center framework. I just want to hear from you. What do you think about that?
So the framework itself is sort of disciplinary agnostic. It doesn't matter that you know, we're doing training right now, creating healing centered frameworks for physicians who work in communities of color. So it doesn't depend on the field as much as the framework. I would say, however, that I've seen people say they're doing healing-centered engagement, and it's really a hodgepodge of really other things. And that's cool, but there are some specific things people need to be thinking about in engaging healing-centered engagement.
So another thing that, you know, you kind of touched on with Brittany as well was this piece that's really integral to what you're talking about is the justice, healing justice, and the role of justice. So Kara Page and Patrice Kohlers, they talk about healing justice. My question is, does healing-centered engagement have a bridge to healing justice? And if so, what does it look like? I ask that because it seems like it's there, right? But I'd like to hear your words.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, there's a significant overlap with healing justice, right? And the overlap that I find the connection with is that healing justice suggests that there's a way that we have been sort of socialized in society that think of that my well-being is my responsibility. That my well-being, you know, like the term self-care, right? It's like, I can go and do this thing for me and my own well-being. And so what healing justice says is that you have a right to be well, that it is a right to be well in this society. And that part of that justice is understanding why you're not well, the systems that actually cause harm. And then second, that your engagement in your well-being is not a selfish individual act, that your well-being is a collective response to a system and structure of society that is designed to harm you. So healing justice adequately talks about the role of well-being in the overall architecture of justice. And so where healing-centered engagement comes in, it is, it says, yes, our well-being is a right. The systems have been directed at creating harm. Here's a way that we can begin to restore our well-being in a collective and profound way in our society. So it is sort of a alley-oop to healing justice, right? It says it's the framework, and then we say, or the healing-centered engagement says, okay, here's how we could do it in schools. Here's what it looked like in juvenile probation. Here's what it'll look like in social work. And it gives guide rails to actually thinking about and thinking about well-being in a collective way.
So one kind of final question, and this is, as an integrated practice, what can mental health professionals do to honor themselves and avoid burnout in a healing-centered manner as they are holding space and experiencing the collective grief that we are currently?
I make sure that we're clear about or try to redefine this notion of self-care. The idea that folks that are in the front lines are engaging, that the recognition that the well-being of our communities and clients are just as critical as the well-being of the workforce supporting them. And you can't really separate it. So you can't really do healing-centered engagement with young people on the South Side of Chicago in schools if you haven't thought about the well-being of those teachers and administrators in that school as well, that those systems of support have to be in place. We look at well-being and healing-centered model on those three levels. So one, I would say to those folks that are on the front line is one, develop a set of practices that you're constantly engaged in, not just individually, but collectively. That might be three or four people where every week or every 2 weeks you get together and you share stories about your work. But that there's an exchange that happens when I share what's happening with my work, not just technically, but empathetically. Right? About the doubts. Why am I doing this? Should I be doing this? I'm tired, shit, right? Like all of these things that we have that we don't share because we think it's just us. So create a practice that there's ongoing sort of deeper self-reflection about who we are in this work, right? And that's at the individual level. At the interpersonal level, it's important to really create structures in an institution that support well-being of teams, right? So it might be mental health days. It might be giving people sabbaticals. It might be creating opportunities to work across teams, right? But it's really trying to create an interpersonal sense of well-being in these institutions. And thirdly, the policies and practices of the institution itself need to be aligned, which is, do these policies actually create harm or are they directed toward restoration? And that's everything from policies around hiring, from discipline policies to how you're training people to engage and work with young people. So right now, there are people having conversations right now about the role of juvenile halls in California because they're directed to incarcerate kids. So what does it mean if you just change the juvenile halls to something else, but the people who are trained in them were trained to lock kids up? What means you have to really retrain them to say, actually, your job is not to lock kids up anymore. Your job is to sit and listen to them, tell their stories. Your job is to be a healer. So it means you have to actually create the policies in your institution to restore the workforce so that they can actually show up in powerful ways for young people.
Thank you so much. And thank you for spending this time with us. It's been invaluable just to hear your perspective. I think that anybody listening to this podcast would definitely get a lot out of what they can pull into their practice too. So thank you so much for that.
Yes. I also want to give you thanks. I know for me, it's been a long journey in learning how to best practice youth development, how to best help communities. And I've had to lean on my own experience a lot, things that worked for me, things that I can relate to and bring that to the table when I'm working with young people in a healing and community capacity. And your work just helps to provide the words and the language to share like what we're doing. And so thank you.
Thank you, Brittany and Nadia. It was a pleasure to be here, and the work that you're doing is transforming communities and families. So keep it up.
Wow. You talked about a book.
Yes, you said a book.
I'm writing a book now called Pivot, Four Tiny Changes to Transforming Our Society, built on some of the, it'll be out, I'm writing it right now, so it'll be out next year. But it's really about these things that we need to do as leaders that require us to do the kind of reflection, the kind of transformative relationship building, how we create a vision, like you said, Nadia, about dreaming and imagination is not something we do when we have time to do it. Like, it's the real work of justice is to dream. And then really ways to think about creating flow, going down in our lives. Like, all of us have these to-do lists. We are rushing to do. We have this addiction to frenzy. And that addiction to frenzy doesn't make us effective for deeper transformative change. And so I do some interviews and a lot of just me thinking on page thoughts. And so the book will be out hopefully next October. I hope you invite me back to share it with your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. And I definitely love that tease. Now I'm like so excited about it because I think it speaks to my heart. We don't make room for healing relationships. And then that gets us in a mess of trouble. So I'm going to be looking for your book.
Great.
Thank you everyone for participating and helping us pull this together.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks so much, you guys. And look forward to seeing the final podcast or hearing it.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.